This is episode 5, How to Deal with Pushback.
Welcome to the Zoe Routh Leadership Podcast, your source of strategies and insights to make you a better leader. Influence, improve, inspire.
Welcome and happy Halloween. I love Halloween. It was one of my favorite festivals. Did you call it a festival? Event as a kid. You got to dress up in these crazy funky clothes, and my mom always did a fantastic job of making awesome costumes, traipse around the neighborhood with, and then come home after a couple hours with a mega score of chocolate and candy. I mean, really, what's not to like about Halloween? It's so fun. You get to carve a pumpkin and you get to decorate your house. But I have to say, here in Australia, it's not really a done thing. Halloween hasn't seemed to have taken off. And I wanted to go all out this year. I went to the shops to buy some decorations for the house. And there was just this lame, and I mean really lame, fake cobwebs with spiders in it. So I tried to put that up and it was just crap, really. I got all my candy ready, so all my chocolates to give out to the kids, because this time not everybody participates in it. It's actually hardly done thing at all. Put a balloon out the front that indicates, yeah, I'm into Halloween. You can come to my house for chocolates. And nobody came. So disappointing. I'm not sure why I'm surprised. In 15 years, no one has come to the door on Halloween. But I thought maybe this year, there'll be kids dressed up and trawling around. So anyway, North America does Halloween beautifully. And I miss it. So there you go. Fun Aussie fact for the day. I've got some exciting news, lots of amazing things happening. So my latest book, Moments, Leadership When It Matters Most, goes to the printer this Friday. Dun, dun, dun. So the editing, the proofreading, it's all happening this week. And it goes to the print machine, the printing guys, at the end of this week. Hurrah! I've listed advanced purchase orders on my website, so you can get an advanced purchase copy for only $1 shipping. Now available just in time for Christmas. So if you want to order some books for yourself or for your colleagues or for your clients or for your family, do so now. And we'll ship them from December 1st. So plenty of time for lovely Christmas presents. I'm really excited about it. So you can find the book that will be listed on my website, zoerouth.com. Just click on books and voila, the beautiful copy of Moments will be there just for you. And along with the book, I've got the book launch. So if you're in Canberra on December the 1st, please come and join us for lunch. We've got a beautiful banquet at the Ottoman, like my favorite restaurant. That's where Rob and I got married. It just has tremendous ambiance, amazing food, great prices. We got a special room, and the bubbles for the lunch are on me. So you can get a little tipsy on my bank. It's fine. And you'll also get a personally autographed copy of Moments, of course. So it'd be great to have you there if you're around in Canberra on December the 1st. And you can sign up and register on my website. I'll put that in the show notes. So if you go to zoerouth.com/podcast/5, like the number 5, there'll be a link there to the event where you can register. And speaking of events, the big event of next year, the Edge of Leadership, my one-day unconference, is taking registrations now, the super duper early bird special, which means the registration fee is $324, I think, as compared to the full price of $800. So if you are smart and you're organized, you will get rewarded with a cheap ticket price. Why would you want to come to this event? Well, it's going to rock Canberra, I have to say. It's March 28th, 2017. And an unconference is basically not a conference. So a conference is typically you get talked at a lot. And I don't want that. I want this to be an event where people walk away with really great leadership insights, really great connections with their fellow attendees, and a really good plan for moving ahead, particularly around social agenda. So the theme for this conference is all about developing your business edge. And those three things, the social connections, your leadership thinking, and how you bring social agenda to your business are the key premises by which we can develop our competitive edge in business. That and the amazing Dr. Jason Fox, who, you know, I'm a raving fangirl of, is going to be our keynote speaker. He's just great to listen to watch, to read his books. He's hilarious. He's so genuine and so humble, and he's got brilliant things to teach about how to navigate uncertainty in the future. And we've got a lot to learn from him. So he'll be headlining there. And at the moment, I'm also working on finalizing the case study participants of local Canberra entrepreneurs and business owners who do a brilliant job of including social agenda as part of their business and making a huge contribution to the community. All that's happening, you can get the details and register now at zoerouth.com. Click on work and you'll find the Edge of Leadership Unconference site there. Get in now because the super duper early bird special will finish at the end of November. So you don't want to miss out. So the question I'm pondering at the moment, and it's kind of just brewing around and I'm not sure what it means, is this. So I think there's a new shape of organizations that's really starting to emerge and become more mainstream. And I'm not sure everybody's got a real handle on this. So this thought came about as I was speaking to the guys from Outward Bound. They are the co-recipients of the fundraising that's coming from the Edge of Leadership, my event. So Edge of Leadership is raising funds for Men's Link, which is a local charity that supports young guys who are basically at risk of going off the rails, and they provide them with free mentoring services. And Men's Link has teamed up with Outward Bound, which is my old stomping ground. I worked there for 10 years. Amazing, doing outdoor experiential education. And they're doing a program with Outward Bound with these young fellas in their second year of mentoring to help develop their leadership throughout the year. And they do this 8-day or 7-day outdoor leadership program. So for me, that was very exciting. And all the proceeds from the conference are going to support Men's Link and Outward Bound. So I was meeting with the Outward Bound guys and they were giving me the updates on what's happening there. You know, how is the business structured? They've made some significant structural changes and business changes, which I thought were quite interesting. And one of the significant shifts is that their instructors, their on the ground frontline team are mostly independent contractors now, which is the polar opposite of what happened when I was there. So when I was there, it was, if you were an instructor, a field person, you were employed 100% all the time by Outward Bound, and you lived on the property and you lived, breathed it, and that was it. It was a big community of young people living and breathing Outward Bound. And now it's totally different. So now they have a pool of instructors that they call on during peak times when the business is on, and they hire them and they come out on a casual basis and away they go. And this in the outdoor experiential industry has been, you know, half and half. There's been some organizations that have had full-time staff and many that have just done the contract model. And I was really surprised to hear it that Outward Bound had gone this way. Not that there's anything wrong with it necessarily. It just portends a huge shift in the organization and perhaps in businesses elsewhere as well, as we look at how talent management is actually managed. In old solid organizations with a strong history, talent management was really, you got your talent in, you looked after them and you maintained them on a permanent basis. And that's how you managed your staffing. And you did everything to hang on to them. Now, the trend, and this is an identified trend, it's out there on many websites and many research organizations. The future trend for employees is that up to 40% of the workforce will be independent contractors. So maybe it's not such a surprise then that that's also happening for organizations like Outward Bound, who had very much a strong emphasis, let's build a community. And so what does this mean? It means that organizations will have to work really hard at making sure that their favorite contractors actually come and work with them. So, because that's one of the problems of having contract staff, they may or may not be available when you need them, and you may get contracts at the last minute. So there's this need to be even more fierce in your engagement with your talent and your contractors, as well as really flexible. So this flexible organization structure I think, will mean stripping back a lot of the resources and infrastructure that are possibly burdening organizations. So I'm thinking about organizations that have big properties, big overheads that was needed when you had a solid, perpetual, permanent staff. And now when you shrink that to a core of people who are basically in sales and management and then bringing in the frontline staff, you don't need such a huge amount of assets. So how do you get, how do you be responsive to that? I think the organizations that are shifting this way need to work this out pretty quickly. Otherwise, they're going to be too top heavy in their infrastructure. A really great resource for this in terms of what needs to happen for organizations to navigate change more broadly in these emerging trends is Patrick Hollingworth's book, The Light and Fast Organization. Fantastic book. It's well written, well researched, and it maps a way of how organizations can be light and fast. Now, Patrick is an Everest expeditioner. He's a mountaineer. He's like a mountain of a man, too. He's like, I don't know, he's 6'3" or 6'4". He's huge. And he's climbed Everest. I think, did he get to the top? I think he got very near to the top. He doesn't talk about it that much in his book, actually. So he uses the whole mountaineering examples as a metaphor for how organizations need to be light and fast in their approach to dealing with the future. You can't go and assault a mountain expedition style, which means huge amounts of resources, and you plow on regardless of circumstances. So you have all this like gear and equipment, and you basically, yeah, attack the mountain. What he says is that the smart mountaineers, the ones that summit quickly and safely, are the ones who are light and fast. They pack light, they watch the changing circumstances, and they take action when the conditions are right. And Patrick says that this is what organizations need to do. You need to strip away everything that's burdening you so you don't get caught in that, well, we have it, therefore we must go. We had this plan, we had this strategy that was set for 3 years, and therefore we must follow it through. Pat says, actually, you just need to strip everything back, watch, understand, predict what's going on in the environment, and then quickly attack it. Quickly, zip up the mountain, zip down again. So zip into the market and zip out again. And he says, this is what's going to help people survive and be masterful at managing all the tsunami of change. If you look at all the amazing stuff that's happening out there with artificial intelligence and robots and changing technology when it comes to renewable resources, as some examples of the massive trends that are going to upend people, such as, and the other one that I mentioned started the program with, was this whole idea of contract staff becoming the default model or the more prominent model for doing business. It really needs to change how we think about how we engage with staff, contractors, and our clients, because there's issues around consistency and quality and policy management, really. So that was my gristly pondering thought of the day, and it has huge repercussions for you. So the topic for today is how to deal with pushback, and it's linked to this whole idea of changing circumstances of staff, because one of the things that's affecting some of my clients is this shift in staffing. It's not necessarily the contract piece that is having an effect, though actually in some organization it is. It's this whole idea of, instead of linear top-down management, that's been sort of scrapped and reshaped for matrix management or lattice-type organization. So where there's versatility and movement sideways, laterally, as well as up and down. So what this means from a practical point of view is that in your workplace, you may be working on a project basis. And on these projects, you have different roles, different teams, different participants, and we need to sort out who does what and how decisions get made and how things are communicated. Otherwise, it's a debacle. And one of my clients, or actually a couple of them in this workshop, were saying, yeah, I'm on this project, I'm the project leader, and yet I don't have authority to tell people what to do. How do I get them to do what I need them to do? Because they don't work as fast as I do. They don't seem to have as much as a discipline as I do. They don't seem to take it as seriously as I do. And I don't want to be a micromanagement jerk that sort of just checks in with them every 5 minutes to make sure it's happening. So how do I do that? That was the challenge. So the real challenge in matrix management or polypod working, where you work on several different projects with several different teams, is that often we show up and we have no authority. So we have influence and we have responsibility often, but not necessarily authority where we can make decisions over other people's participation, behavior, or employment. So we've got nothing, no big stick, if you like, to wield. All we have is our capacity for influence, which is real leadership skill anyway. So let's look at what not to do if you're trying to influence people on your polypod team on a project and you're trying to get buy-in and they're pushing back. So what's happening for people here? So why would people push back on a project? Presumably they're interested in the project, they're engaged with it, they've got a stake in the game because it's part of their work, whether as a contractor or as a staff member. So why push back? What's really under the surface there? There's five things really that I think can be going on for people. And the first one is this. They don't see the reasons why the project is important. Yeah. What seems obvious to us may not be obvious to other people. So they might think, well, we're doing this thing. Why? Because it's somebody's pet project, because it's something to do, it's a time filler. So they haven't bought into the rationale. So, you know, you have pushback because they're not bought in. Great book on buy-in, actually, is Simon Dowling's new book, Work With Me. And he goes through it in great detail about how to build buy-in and what are the extenuating circumstances and approaches you can go for that. I'll put that in the show notes as well, zoerouth.com/podcast/5. And so the link to his book will be there along with Patrick's book too. So not seeing the reasons why can be a real stumbling block. You know that for yourself too. If somebody asks you to do something, imagine yourself as a four-year-old kid. You know, Johnny, can you do this? Why? That little annoying four-year-old is still within us. And we need to have good reasons to do things, particularly as adults. So that's the first thing that can cause resistance. The second thing is they may have other priorities that you don't know about. So they might be working on five different projects and all are rated as top by their respective managers because they're still supervisors in a matrix organization. There's still people who are accountable for things. And they may have given your colleagues a directive that this needs to be done by Friday, say, for example. So these things might be at play about why the resistance to your particular project might be in play. So it's up to you to find that out, really. What else is on their plate? And is that contributing to the pushback? They may have a different work style to you. And I was having a conversation with a client yesterday, and he's a wise man. He goes, I can't believe that people don't know that people actually do have different work styles. I said, you know, you'd be really surprised. When I do the training that shows people about people's different work behavior preferences and how each of us comes to work with a different agenda and a different way of doing things, it is consistently amazing that some people have real penny drop moments when they go, oh, you mean not everybody likes to work the way that I do? Yeah, I've had that moment too, and it's quite confronting. It's like, but this is the best way to be. I'm thinking to myself, this is the fun way to approach work. It seems like the natural way to do work, and it is fun and it is natural for me. It's not fun and natural for other people necessarily. So my approach to work is quite dynamic, it's quite creative, it's very fast paced. Other people have very different pace, slow, methodical, linear, sequential, which would personally drive me bananas. So that's a small example of how people like to do work differently. And if you're experiencing pushback on a project, it's possible that they've got a different work style to you, and they may find your work style irritating, confronting, oppressive, de-energizing, don't know. And it's something that we as leaders need to be extremely mindful of, is how we like to operate is often quite different than other people. Doesn't mean that we then have to try and convert people to our way of doing things. We just need to work with the style that works best for them so that the end result happens in a timely manner. I think that's really what pushback's about. It's like, I need you to do this thing by bleh date. And we don't often get that happening sometimes if there's pushback. And it could be because of the style, work style preference, and the priority piece. So we need to work that out. They have a different style to us. What else? Pushback can also happen because change can be threatening. And, you know, a great example of this, I'm looking at going to a new gym. I've been at my current gym for 12 years, and it's a little old. The bathrooms aren't that great. It doesn't have a pool. It doesn't have a really nice sauna or steam room, which I really like to incorporate into my regular routine. So I'm like, shall I go and look at another nearby gym? So on the weekend, I went and looked at this brand new gym, and it's got all the modern facilities. It's got everything my current gym has, plus. It has tennis courts, it has squash courts, it has an indoor pool, it has an outdoor pool. It's got a recovery center with the sauna, with a steam room, with a soaking tubby thing, and you can do the hot cold therapy. It's got a lovely cafe, and it's got free Wi-Fi and a lounge area. Like, it's pretty swish compared to my rundown old gym. And yet I was in my old gym this morning, and there were all the familiar faces of all the people I've known for years working out, and all the staff who are really, they know my story. They've known me for 12 years. Shifting to a new gym all of a sudden felt threatening. You know, who would know me there? Who would support me there? Who would know all of my history and actually care? And even though the lure of new facilities and the sauna is pretty strong, change can actually be quite threatening. You know, like, will I have a community there? Will I like it there? And those fears create resistance. And it's the same for the people that we work with on different jobs. If we ask them to change a work process or change something, it can be off-putting. It's like, ooh, where's this coming from? Will I be able to do it? Will I be competent at this? What does this mean in terms of my status? And these kinds of things bubble up for folks, and that creates pushback or resistance. So it might be an element of change that's causing people to push back. And you as a leader need to really figure that out. Is the pushback because there's a change that could be potentially threatening to them on some level? And the fifth reason that might be going on for people about resisting change or having pushback is they may actually genuinely disagree with the decision. I know, it's shocking. Disagree? Oh my goodness. It's true. You've probably been in this situation too, right? Where somebody's asked you to do work on a project and you think about this and you go, that's crap. It's a really bad decision. It's a bad project. It's going to end badly. And you yourself may have had resistance and pushback to it. So something like that may also be going on for people. And depending on your positional authority, background, expertise, they may or may not voice that. So you may have to dig a little with them to find out, is there disagreement with the actual decision and project that you need to surface and deal with? And if they're uncomfortable with you because they don't like you, they don't like your style, or they're intimidated, you need to change your approach to that to get some buy-in so they can actually have those difficult conversations around this. So five things that could be going on for folks. They don't see the reasons why. They may have other priorities you don't know about. They might have a different work style for you. It might be change that is threatening. They feel they need to go into protective mode, or they genuinely disagree with the decision. So what to do? Well, let's focus on what not to do first. The first thing not to do is threaten people, i.e. please do this or else. Fill in the blank for some subtle punishment, like I'll report it to the boss, or I'll demote you, or I'll make a negative recommendation, whatever. So threats, not a good strategy, really. Like, definitely does not build buy-in, even though it's a shortcut, right? So do this or else is a shortcut. And I just remember my dad using that out of exasperation with me. Do this or you get suspended, or you get sent to your room or whatever. So yeah, doesn't work so well with your colleagues. Threatening, not so good. bribing, not so good either. So that's like, come on, do me a favor. If you do this, then I'll do X, Y, Z for you. It just puts you in a bad position. It means that you surrender a lot of your power and influence because you feel like you need to cajole people. And all of a sudden, instead of having a professional, equal relationship, you are on the back foot. So threatening is about you being on the front foot and intimidating, and them being on the back foot. Bribing is the other way around. And nothing good can come from that. The third thing of what not to do is to run to mama or run to papa. This is where you might be having pushback with somebody and then you daub them in by going reporting it to the big boss. And sometimes it's useful to escalate the challenge to somebody else who can help you deal with it. However, you only do this when you've done due process. So you need to attempt to resolve the issue and to get buy-in and commitment to the activity with your colleague first. Often I've seen this with more inexperienced people is that as soon as there's any sign of like resistance or pushback and people not following through on what we want them to do, I've had a client just go, right, I'm done with this. And they jumped two levels in the chain of command because there's still a chain of command, even a matrix management system, and basically campaigned to the powers that be. And so that made everyone look bad. It made the colleague look bad. It made my client's two levels of bosses look bad because all of a sudden it's like, why is this person coming to me? You know, they should be going to their direct manager or the deputy. This is being escalated. So why, you know, what's going on? You guys have, you need to sort your mess out basically. So everybody looks bad doing that. And I can understand why we might feel like we need to jump rank is if we're not getting traction or we feel like we're not getting traction with our colleagues or with our managers. And so we do a last ditch attempt and escalate it. And sometimes there's valid reason for that. I'm thinking in the case of like it's a ethical challenge or an ethical dilemma that you've tried to raise first with the person, next with the manager, and you feel that nobody is really paying attention to this ethical issue, then, of course, it's important to escalate it. If it's a case of, so-and-so won't help me do this project, that's really different to so-and-so is going against our values and is doing something illegal. There's a very different protocol at play there. So we don't want to run to mama and papa unless we've had due process and there's good reason to do so, i.e. ethical or legal or professional reasons. The fourth thing not to do is to whinge and to judge. So whinging is such a great Australian term. We don't have that in Canada. And basically it means to complain. Except whinge, it kind of even sounds like that in the word, doesn't it? Whinge. So what we don't want to do if we have pushback is whine about other people and complain and feel exasperated and judge them for being slackers or disinterested or noncommittal, etc. Because of all the reasons we listed previously about what might be going on for people. So that's often our default out of frustration because we are so mired in our work and all the things that we have to do. Sometimes we just go, oh, you know, they're just that person is so difficult and we dismiss it. And that doesn't help us at all. So the last thing to do what not to do is to then default to doing it yourself and becoming a rescuer. So I see this often too with the more junior staff is that they've tried to get buy-in. They've tried to get people to cooperate with them. And then they go, fine, I'll do it. If you won't do it, I'll do it. And then they work all weekend till midnight, getting this thing up and going. And that helps no one. The person ends up burnt out. Everybody else learns that you're basically a rescuer and a go-to person. And it perpetuates a negative cycle of, yeah, I don't have to do what they ask me to because they're just going to do it anyway. So there you go. So important not to fall into the rescuer trap and to hold your ground and to work through the issue. So let's get on to working through the issue. What can we do here? And there's six different things that you need to keep in mind in dealing with pushback. So imagine what's going on for people first. So just do a little bit of reflection around that. And then when you start to communicate with them, start with the why. Thank you, Simon Sinek. His fabulous work on Start With Why, either his TED Talk or his books, are a fabulous place to get au fait with this whole notion of Start With Why. And Simon Sinek's great hypothesis, great idea, is really about people don't care what you do unless they know why you do it. And I think that's really important. So instead of telling someone, hey, do this project, the first thing they want to know is why. Why is this important? And if you can link it to a bigger picture of why it's important, it's structurally or strategically important to the organizations or to your clients or to the stakeholders, and you explain that, paint the bigger picture of why it's important, then that's one of the most easiest ways to get buy-in. And I love the examples we've heard before, you know, when Kennedy was in the Oval Office in the U.S. and he wanted to put a man on the moon, everybody who worked at NASA, including the janitorial staff, were working to put a man on the moon. And they all bought into that vision. So even if their job was to clean floors, they knew that their contribution was leading towards that. And I think today in modern organizations, we don't have that enough. We don't have that bigger picture story of what's connecting people to the why of their work. And we certainly don't have it when it boils down to smaller polypod work often. We don't stop and pause and go, okay, why are we doing this? What's the bigger picture piece? What is this feeding? What is this serving? Who is it serving? What's the feel good in it for us? So start with that piece as a way of building buy-in and dealing with pushback. The second piece is, this is a two-way thing, right? You've got to listen to the other people. Find out what's going on for them. Do they have other priorities? Have they got something going on personally, which means they're completely overloaded? Maybe they've been sick for a week. Maybe they've got a sick family member. Maybe they're thinking about leaving the organization. I don't know. Find out. Find out what else is on the agenda for them. And here's the thing, right? People love to feel heard. So even if their decision doesn't get taken up or their advice doesn't get taken up, the fact that they felt heard is often the most important things. A great example of a leader doing this well is the new vice chancellor at University of Canberra. So he has arrived, what is he up to now? Day 60. On his first day at the university, he said, I'm doing 100 days of listening. I want to hear from as many people about anything and everything about the university. So my 100 days of listening is happening. No major changes are going to be implemented in that time frame. So in the meantime, there are things that he needs to make a decision on, right? Because they have budget systems that are on a calendar basis. So he needs to make decisions around some strategy, at least budgeting, before the 100 days is up. However, know how excited people are at the university that the vice chancellor said, I've got 100 days of listening. So the intention is that he will listen and they will be heard. And regardless of what decisions get made, people feel like they have a voice and somebody cares. They understand, and this is from talking to a lot of the staff at the university, they understand that not every perspective can be acted on. So not every idea will be taken up. And yet if it's heard, that makes all the difference. So if you can do that for your colleagues, if you listen to them and reiterate, paraphrase, acknowledge their ideas and their concerns, that act of hearing them truly, not just sitting there and hearing blah, 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 but actually acknowledging their concerns and ideas, that will go a long way of creating collaborative approach to dealing with the issues and to dealing with pushback. So the third thing to do in dealing with pushback is timing. And Simon Dowling talks about this in his book, Work With Me, in that sometimes it's not the right time to try and push something forward. And the analogy he uses is surfing. I love this one because it's so true. My husband is a surfer, and whenever we're near the coast, it's like, okay, the first thing we do when we get up is go check the surf. And so we drive around to the break and have a look. What's going on with the waves? Is the wind onshore, offshore? Is it flat? Is it pumping? Is it dumping? And we check the surf. What are the conditions? What are the prevailing conditions? And sometimes it's just not worth it to go out because it's the waves are dumping or there's no surf at all, etc. And Simon says, and Simon says, yeah, I didn't plan that. Simon Dowling says in his book that often trying to build buy-in is like surfing. You need to check the prevailing conditions and see if the time is right. If the time's right, go for it. Broach the subject, deal with the topic, and sometimes you need to back away. Why would you want to back away? Because of some of the things that people might be experiencing: work overload, competing priorities, dealing with other changes, etc. The fourth thing that you can do to build buy-in and avoid pushback is offer people a choice. And you can make discussions an invitation. Often people feel like victims at work because they've been told to do something and they feel like they have no choice. And the reality is we always have a choice. We always have a choice about how we respond to something. And if you treat your colleagues in the same way, like that this is a choice for you to opt in or out, then without making an ultimatum, I think that's the art of doing this as a leader. So don't make it an ultimatum, as in do this project or there's no future for you. Example of an ultimatum. Example of doing an invitation is, well, we're working on this project. I'd love to have you be involved and engaged on this. I'm really seeking your input and your participation in it. It's your choice whether you come to that willingly or not. Certainly, if you have resistance to this project, you can bring it up elsewhere. My invitation to you is to work with me on this. Sounds really different. Maybe the implication is the same, but the invitation is totally different. It's got a different energy to it. So if you can, avoid giving them an ultimatum and a dictation and a directive, and make it invitational and collaborative if you can. The fifth suggestion is to speak from the heart. So whenever you show up to work with people, when you come from a place of genuine compassion and concern, this will build rapport. And people will know that you're being authentic. And if it's a decision that you don't like that much either, then you can own that and you can talk about that. You know, this is a difficult decision. I don't feel great about it. And this is why I think we need to implement it. This is what the repercussions might be if we don't. These are the repercussions if we do. And I invite you to participate with me on this, to engage with me on this. So when you come as a humble, collaborative person, as opposed to a conflicted or competitive or combative participant, then it'll make a huge difference. And the sixth tip is be prepared to make the hard decisions. In leadership, sometimes we have to make decisions that really suck. That's just no other way to get around it. Sometimes we've come to a point where we actually have to let someone go, say, for example, or relocate them to a different project that's they'll be disappointed about and is also best in their best interest and the best in the organization's interest. When we are prepared to make the hard decisions and we can communicate from the heart, then we have a better chance of building buy-in and collaborative engagement on projects because people know that we're always showing up authentically with everyone's best interest at heart. And it'll make it easier for ourselves, too, when we do that, to actually do make the hard decisions. So there you have it. What not to do, what's going on for folks if they are giving you pushback, and the tips on what to do to build buy-in and to avoid and deal with that difficult difficult pushback. So the show notes are listed at zoerauth.com/podcast/5. I'll have links to the books that I mentioned there, as well as links to the book launch, if you can make it, on December 1st. And best actually to sign up for my newsletter at my website so that you can get all the updates live as they happen. In the meantime, live well, lead well, and have a great week.